From PRI, Public Radio International.
Without an inkling of premeditation, she turned to the sheriff, who was breathing and creaking there in standard fashion, and balled her fist and very slowly brought it to his stomach and ground it mock menacingly into him as far as it would go, which was about an inch.
You're listening to James Norton reading from Paget Powell's glorious story, The Winnowing of Mrs. Shooping, which we'll hear in its entirety later on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. This is a Selected Shorts program with two stories about remarkable couples, each featuring a pretty impressive male person in an encounter with an even more impressive and commanding female counterpart. We start with Rita Dove's story, Secondhand Man. The reader is the wonderful Broadway singer and actor Audra McDonald, and you're in for a treat because this story requires that Audra McDonald sing.
Virginia couldn't stand it when someone tried to shorten her name, like Jenny, for example. But James Evans didn't. He set his 12-string guitar down real slow. "Miss Virginia," he said, "you're a fine piece of woman." Seemed he'd been asking around, knew everything about her. Knew she was bold and proud and didn't cotton to no silly niggers. "Virginia," he said, nice and slow, almost Russian the way he said it. Right then and there, she knew this was the man for her. He courted her just inside a year, came by nearly every day. First, she wouldn't see him for more than a half an hour at a time. She'd send him away, told him she had other things to do. And he knew better than to try and force her. Another fellow did that once. Kept coming by when she said she had other things to do. She told him he'd do it once more, she'd be waiting at the door with a pot of scalding hot water to teach him some manners. And she did, too. Fool didn't believe her. She had the pot waiting right on the stove, and when he came up those stairs, she was standing in the door. He took one look at her face and turned and ran. He was lucky, too, that those steps were so steep. She only got a little piece of his pant leg. No, James knew his stuff. He'd come on time and stay till she told him he needed to go. She met him out at Summit Beach one day. In the 20s, that was the place to go on hot summer days. Clean, yellow sand all around the lake and an amusement park that ran from morning till midnight. She went there with a couple of girlfriends. Well, they were younger than her and a little silly, but they were sweet. And Virginia was 19 then. High time, everyone used to say to her, but she'd just lift her head and go on about her business. She weren't going to marry just any old Negro. He had to be perfect. Now, there was a man who was chasing her around about that time. Tall, dark Negro, Sterling Williams was his name. Pretty as a panther, and married he was. Well, at least that's what everyone said. Left a wife in Washington, D.C., a little crazy, the wife, and poor Sterling was trying to get a divorce. Well, Sterling was at Summit Beach that day, too. He followed Virginia around, trying to buy her root beer. Everybody loved root beer that summer. Root beer and vanilla ice cream, the Boston Cooler. But she wouldn't pay him no mind. People said she was crazy. Sterling was the best catch in Akron, they said. "Not for me," Virginia said. "I don't want no secondhand man." But Sterling wouldn't give up. He had to keep buying root beers and having to drink them himself. Then she saw James. He'd just come up from Tennessee, working his way up on the riverboats. Folks said his best friend had been lynched down there, and he turned his back on the town and said he was never coming back. Well, when she saw this cute little man in a straw hat and a 12-string guitar under his arm, she got a little flustered. Her girlfriends whispered around to find out who he was, but she acted like she didn't even see him. He was the hit of Summit Beach. Played that 12-string guitar like a devil. They take off their shoes and sit on the beach toward the evening, and all the girls loved James. Oh, Jimmy, they squeal, play us a love song. And he'd laugh and pick out a tune. I'll give you a dollar if you come out tonight. If you'll come out tonight, if you'll come out tonight. I'll give you a dollar if you'll come out tonight and dance by the light of the moon. Oh, then the girls would giggle. Jimmy, they'd scream, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Then he'd sing a second verse. I danced with a girl with a hole in her stocking, and her heel kept a rocking, and her heel kept a rocking. I danced with a girl with a hole in her stocking, and we danced by the light of the moon. Then they'd all priss and preen their feathers and wonder what would be best, to be in fancy clothes and go on being courted by these dull factory fellows, or to have a hole in their stocking and dance with James. Virginia never danced. She sat a bit off to one side and watched them make fools of themselves. Then one night, near season's end, they were all sitting down by the water and everyone had on sweaters and was in a foul mood because the cold weather was coming and there wouldn't be no more parties. Someone said something about hating to have the good times end, and James struck up a nice and easy tune, and he looked straight across the fire at Virginia. As I was lumbering down the street, down the street, a handsome gal I happened to meet. Oh, she was fair to view. I'd like to make that gal my wife. Gal, my wife, that gal, my wife. I'd be happy all my life if I had her here by me. She knew he was the man. She'd known it a long while, but she was just biding her time. He called on her the next day. She said she was busy canning peaches. He came back the day after. They sat on the porch and watched the people go by. He didn't talk much, except to say her name like that. Virginia, he said, you're a mighty fine woman. She sent him home a little after that. He showed up again a week later. Well, she was angry at him and told him she didn't have time for playing around. But he'd brought his 12-string guitar and said he'd been practicing all week just to play a couple songs for her. So she let him in, made him sit on the stool while she sat on the porch swing. He sang the first song. It was a floor thumper. There's a gal in our town, she wears a yellow striped gown, and when she walks the streets around, the hollow of her foot makes a hole in the ground. Old folks, young folks, clear the kitchen. Old folks, young folks, clear the kitchen. Old Virginie never tire. She got a little mad then. But she knew he was baiting her, seeing how much she would take. She knew he wasn't singing about her, and she already heard how he said her name. Well, it was time to let the dog in out of the rain, even if he shook his wet all over the floor. So she leaned back, put her hands on her hips, and said, I know you ain't singing about me. Virginia, he replied with a grin that would have put Rudolph Valentino to shame. I'd never sing about you that way. He pulled a yellow scarf out of his trouser pocket, like melted butter it was, with fringes. I saw it yesterday and thought how nice it would look against your skin, he said. It was the first present she ever accepted from a man. Then he sang his other song. I'm coming, Virginia, I'm coming to stay. Don't hold it against me for running away. And if I can win ya, I nevermore will roam. I'm coming, Virginia, my Dixieland, my home. She was gone for him. Not like those girls on the beach. I mean, she had enough sense to left to crack a joke or two. What, you saying I look like the state of Virginia? She asked. Well, he laughed. But she was gone. She didn't let him know it, though. Not for a long while. Even when he asked her to marry him. 8 months later, he was trembling and thought she just might refuse out of some woman's whim. No, he courted her proper. Every day for a little while, they'd sit on the porch until it got too cold, and then they'd sit in the parlor with two or three bright lamps on. Her mother and father were glad Virginia had found a beau, but they weren't taking any chances. Everything had to be proper. He got down, all trembly, on one knee and asked her to be his wife. She said yes. Well, there's a point when all this dignity and stuff get in the way of destiny, so he kept trembling. He didn't believe her. What? He said. I said yes, Virginia answered. She was starting to get angry. Then she saw he meant it, and went into the other room to ask her father for her hand in marriage. But people are too curious for their own good. And there's some things that they never need to know, but they're gonna find them out one way or another. James had come all the way up from Tennessee, and that should have been far enough, but he couldn't hide that snake anymore. It just crawled out from under the rock when it was good and ready. The snake was Jeremiah Morgan. Some fellows from Akron had gone off for work on the riverboats, and some of these fellows had heard about James. That 12-string guitar and straw hat of his made him pretty popular. So story got to town that James had a baby somewhere. And joined up to this baby, but long dead and gone, was a wife. Virginia had been married 6 months when she found out from sweet talk inside stepping Jeremiah Morgan, who never liked her nohow after she'd laid his soul to rest one night when he'd taken her home from a dance. She always carried a brick in her purse. No man could get the best of her. Jeremiah must have been the happiest man in Akron the day he found out. He found out later than most people. You see, things like that have a way of circulating first among those who know how to keep it from spreading to the wrong folks. Then, once the gossip's gotten to everyone else, it's handed over to the one who knows what to do with it. Ask that husband of yours what else he left in Tennessee besides his best friend, was all Jeremiah said at first. Well, no good Negro like Jeremiah Morgan could make Virginia beg for information. She wouldn't bite. I ain't got no need for asking my husband nothing, she said, and walked away. She was going to choir practice. He stood where he was and yelled after her like any old common person. Mrs. Evans always talking about being number one. It looks like she's number two after all. Well, her ears burned from the shame of it. But she went on to choir practice and sang her prettiest, and straight when she was back home, she asked, what's all this number two business? James broke down and told her the whole story, how he'd been married before when he was 17 and his wife dying in childbirth and the child not quite right because it was blue when it was born, and how when his friend was strung up, he saw no reason for staying. And how when he met Virginia, he found out pretty quick what she'd done to Sterling Williams and that she'd never have no second-hand man, and he just had to have her, so he just never said a word about his past. She took off her coat, hung it in the front closet. She unpinned her hat, set it in its box on the shelf. She reached in the back of the closet, brought out his hunting rifle and a box of bullets. She didn't see no way out but to shoot him. "You put that down," he shouted. "I love you." "Well, you were right not to tell me," she said, "because I sure as sin wouldn't have married you, and I don't want you now." "Virginia," he said, he was real scared, "how can you shoot me like this?" Oh, no, she couldn't shoot him when he stood there looking at her with those sweet brown eyes telling her how much he loved her. "You have to sleep sometime." So she sat down and waited. He didn't sleep for 3 nights. He knew she meant business. She sat up in their best chair with the rifle across her lap. But he wouldn't sleep. He sat at the table and told her over and over that he loved her and he hadn't known what else to do with the time. "When I get through killing you," she told him, "I'm going to write to Tennessee and have them send that baby up here. It won't do farming a child out to any relative with an extra plate." She held on to that rifle. Not that he would have taken it from her. Not that it would have saved him. No. The only thing would have saved him was running away. But he didn't run either. Well, sitting there, Virginia had a lot of time to think. He was afraid of what she might do, but he wouldn't leave her. Some of what he was saying was beginning to sink in. He had lied, but that was the only way to get her. Well, she could see the reasoning behind that. And except for that, he was perfect. It was hardly like having a wife before at all. And the baby, well, anyone could see the marriage wasn't meant to be anyway. On the third day, about midnight, she laid down the rifle. "You will join the choir and settle down instead of plucking on that guitar anytime anyone drop a hat. And we will write to your aunt in Tennessee and have that child sent up here." She put the rifle back in the closet. The child never made it to Ohio. It had died a month before Jeremiah ever opened his mouth. And that hit James hard. He thought it was his fault, but Virginia made him see that the child was sick and all, and he was probably better off with his maker than living out half a life. James made a good tenor in the choir. The next spring, Virginia had her first baby. They decided to name her Belle. That's French for beautiful. And she was, too.
Audra McDonald read Rita Dove's story, Secondhand Man. After a brief pause, we'll be back with one of our all-time story favorites, read by James Naughton. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Our second story about a remarkable couple, a strong man and an even stronger woman, is Paget Powell's very funny The Winnowing of Mrs. Shooping. Paget Powell teaches creative writing at the University of Florida, and the story, as you'll see, is set on the edge of a Florida swamp and comes complete with a real Florida sheriff. The reader is the 2-time Tony-winning actor and director, James Norton.
Mrs. Shuping lived on a moribund estate that had once been grand enough in trees alone that a shipbuilder scouting live oaks in the 18th century had bought the tract for wood to make warships for the British Navy. Oak of that sort, when fitted and shipped into 6-inch walls, would not merely withstand or absorb cannonballs, but repel them a good way toward their source. Mrs. Shuping did not know this, but she knew she had big old trees, and she patted their flanks when she strolled the grounds. The house had died. So slatternly, so ratty was it that Mrs. Shuping was afraid to enter it again once she'd worked up the courage to go out of it, which was more dangerous. She'd been hit by boards twice while leaving the house, but never when going in. There was no such thing as falling down insurance, an actuarial nicety that flabbergasted and enraged Mrs. Shuping. Falling down was what really plagued houses. Therefore, that was what you could not protect them from by lottery. She called herself Mrs. Shuping, arbitrarily. She had no husband, nor had she ever found in the least logical the idea of having one man whom you so designated. Wholly preposterous. She had a good toaster. It was a 4-slice commercial stainless square job, missing its push-down knobs, so that you had to depress the naked notched metal thingies to lower the bread. It looked like you'd need a rag to protect your hand, but you did not. Perhaps if you were hustling breakfast in a good diner, you might, but not slowly at home. Life was winnowing for Mrs. Shuping. When she bought the house, she had found a huge collection of opera records, of which she knew nothing except that they sounded ridiculous. This collection she played dutifully over and over until it was memorized, until it could not be said that she was ignorant of opera. When she had mastered the collection, she wondered why, and she sailed the records one by one into the swamp behind the rotting house. She winnowed the collection of opera records until it was a collection of cardboard boxes, and eventually used those to set her first swamp fire. Setting the swamp on fire was not a winnowing of her life, but it did winnow the swamp. The burning seemed to her rather naughty and frivolous, and surprisingly agreeable to look at and to smell. She took an unadult pleasure in them, along with an adult fear that she might be somehow breaking the law, even though the swamp was hers. The second time she set the mangy, tangled tract on fire, the sheriff showed up, and she became sure it was the case that you could not burn your own swamp. The sheriff, whom she had not met before, confirmed her anxiety with his opening remark. "Your swamp is on fire," he said, standing about 15 feet off her right shoulder and slightly behind her. She turned to him and said, not knowing what in hell else she might, "Yes, it is." The sheriff stood there regarding first her and then the swamp and the fire, which gave his face a jack-o'-lantern orange sheen, and said again, "The swamp is on fire." The emphasis was meant to confirm his sympathies with having fires. And upon establishing that bond, he walked briskly to Mrs. Shuping's side and planted his feet and crossed his arms and cocked back to watch the fire with her in an attitude that suggested he would be content to watch for a good long while. When he breathed, His belt and holster creaked. Mrs. Shupin could not tell if his affection for the fire was genuine or a trap of the infamous misdirectional innocuous talk type favored by country police. So she said two things. "Sheriff, I set my opera collection boxes on fire. I confess they were in the swamp." "Then, Sheriff, I do not need a man." The sheriff looked at the fire, followed it up into the high parts where it licked at the grapevines climbing on the tupelo gums. It was a hot yellow heat in the slack, black, muddy gloom of a nothing swamp that needed it. He had been taking pure aesthetic enjoyment from the thing until Mrs. Shupin said what she said, which reminded him that they were not free to enjoy this mayhem and that he had to undo her concern with his presence. Concern with his presence was, more than his actual presence, his job, ordinarily. It was how he made his living. This was the hardest thing about being sheriff. You could not go off duty. A city cop could. They even provided locker rooms and showers for them. And, he imagined, laundry and dry cleaning takeout services for the uniforms. But a sheriff was the sheriff, and he always was up to something. That is why he had to talk like a fool to this woman to get her to let him watch her fire with her. How else excuse standing in front of 5 burning acres and saying, "On fire"? But it had not worked. And this man thing. "Ms. Shoup, I just, it's Shupin," Mrs. Shupin said. "Yes'm, I know. I just like to call you Shoup, though." With this, the sheriff again squared off with a sigh to watch the fire. Whatever he had been about to say, cut off by Mrs. Shupin's correcting him. He hoped he had begun the dismantling of her concerns with his presence, both legal and sexual. He was aware that he had not done much toward either end, but he did not want to babble while watching a good fire. Unless she asked him off the property, he'd hold his ground. Mrs. Shupin was content, having posted her nolo contendere on the fire and her no desire on the man, to let him stand there and breathe and creak if he wanted to. She had been a little hard on the sheriff, she thought. It was the legal part that worried her into overstating the sexual part. Not overstating, misstating. She did not need a man. But wanting was another question. And if all you had to do to get a big, creaking booger like this one was set your backyard on fire, she was all for it. Four months later, the sheriff and Mrs. Shupin had their second date. He saw the smoke from the interstate, where he was parked behind the Starvin' Marvin billboard at such a ridiculous pitch the takeoff was nearly vertical. And he resisted blasting off for speeders unless provoked entirely. What had been provoking him entirely lately was college kids with their feet out the windows of BMWs headed for Dade County, Florida, with their socks on. That was making him strike, lift off or no lift off. He wondered what it was like for a bass, how some lures got by and some did not. For him, it was pink socks. In the absence of pink socks, there was smoke over the Fork Swamp. Mrs. Shuping looked even more fire-lovely than she had at the first fire. This time, she saw him before he spoke. "There won't be a problem with the permit," the sheriff said, instead of the idiocies of last time. There was no problem with the permit because there was no permit. But he thought this was a good way to address those concerns of hers. The sheriff had lost a little weight. Mrs. Shuping had been on intellectual winnowing excursions, and she saw, as a matter of vector analogy, the trajectory of the sheriff toward her and the swale of her sexual self. He had a swag or a sway, something of a gut that suggested, even if a bit cartoonishly, a lion. This big fat tub could get on top of her, she thought. With no identifiable emotion, looking at the crisp, shrieking, blistering fire she had set with no more ado than a Bic lighter jammed open and a pot she didn't want any more full of gasoline. The sheriff took a slow survey of the fire, which was magnificent and loyal. Her little swamp was neatly set on a fork of creek so that the fire could not get away. And turning back, he caught a glance of Mrs. Shuping's profile as she watched the fire. And he thought him a little. And down a bit, he saw her breasts, rather sticking out and firm-looking in the dusky, motley, scrabbled light. Bound up in a sweater and what looked like a salmon-colored bra, through the swamp smoke stinging your eyes on a 40-year-old woman, they could take your breath away. He made to go. "Good, cool fire, Mrs. Shoup," the sheriff said. "I gotta go." "You're leaving, sheriff?" "It's business, purely business." To the sheriff, she seemed relaxed, legally. And there is nothing like a big Ford exit. A little air, and a little time. Mrs. Shuping had been through every consciousness and semi-consciousness and unconsciousness and raised and lowered consciousness program, contributing to every good conscience and bad conscience and middle struggling conscience there is. But now she was a woman in a house so fallen apart that the children had taken it off the haunted register. And she was boiling an egg on a low blue flame. Outside were the large, dark, low-armed oaks. Also outside, beyond the oaks, were the smoldering, ignoble trees. The white, acrid, thin smoke drifted up their charred trunks, and it was ugly. The swamp had powers of recovery that were astounding, though. It was this magical resilience that confirmed Mrs. Shuping as an avid swamp burner. When the swamp came back hairier than it had been before the burning, thicker and nastier, she found the argument for necessary periodic burning, which was, of course, a principle in good forestry. She was not a pyromaniac. She was a land steward. The trees stood out there, fuming and hissing and steaming. Her life continued to winnow. Beyond the disassembly of her opera holdings, Mrs. Shuping had gradually let go of her once prodigious reading. She had read in all topical lay matters. She had taught herself calculus and could read Scientific American without skipping the math. She had taught herself to weld and briefly tried to sculpt in metal. She gave this up after discovering that all she wanted to sculpt ever was a metal sphere, and she could not do it. She had dallied similarly in hydroponics, artificial intelligence, military science, and dress designing. She had read along great book lines and found them mostly a yawn, except for the great pornography books, for which there seemed to be no modern equivalent. She had stopped going out to concerts and movies, etc., which she had done specifically to improve herself, because it got to where, after every trip on the long drive back to the ruined estate, she wondered what was so damned given about improving oneself. The opposite idea seemed at least as tenable. As her tires got worse, it seemed even more tenable, and she began to embrace the idea of winnowing. Travel less, do less. It is more. She found a grocery that still delivered, and she picked up her box of groceries on the front porch, as far as the boys would go. At first, she regretted the winnowing, but then she did not. She had had a mind, but nothing had properly got in its way. That happens. The same for bodies. There were good athletes in this world who had never had the right field or the right ball get in their way. It was particle physics when you got right down to it. And the numbers of people in the world today and the numbers of things to occupy them made the mechanics of successful collision difficult. So she'd burn her swamp, pat her good trees, cook her egg. She had one old clock radio, a GE in a vanilla plastic cabinet with a round dial for a tuner, which she played at night. If there were storms, she listened to the static of lightning. When the swamp had returned in its briary, vitriolic vengeance, reminding her of a beard coming out of a face that was too close to hers, she set it afire a fourth time. The fire went taller than before, so she walked around to the front of the house to see if you could see it from there, and if you could, if it looked like the house was on fire. And there was the sheriff, parking his car. He rolled down the window and said, "I got you two puppies." She looked in at the front seat and saw that he did. Not all puppies are cute, but these seemed abnormally cute. She discarded immediately protest. She was not going to be the sort, no matter how holed up and eccentric, to refuse a dog because of the responsibility and other nonsense. What kind are they? The kind dog fighters give me just before they have themselves a convention. The sheriff opened the door, let the puppies out, and got out himself. They all walked back to the fire. At one point, the sheriff misjudged the ground and veered sharply into Mrs. Shuping and nearly knocked her down. He was so big and tight that he felt like the oak walls of the ships that flung cannonballs back, which Mrs. Shuping did not know had made her trees, under which they now walked, attractive to the shipbuilder 200 years before. The fire was a good one. There was a screaming out of human register as oxygen and carbon clawed each other to pieces, going through peat and leaf and the dirt that somehow stayed up in the leaves even when it rained, giving the swamp its dusty look that would never be right for National Geographic. The dirt in the trees presumably turned to glass, and maybe that was why, Mrs. Shuping thought, the fire always sounded like things breaking, tiny things breaking, a big fiery bull in the shop. Without an inkling of premeditation, she turned to the sheriff, who was breathing and creaking there in standard fashion, and balled her fist and very slowly brought it to his stomach and ground it mock menacingly into him as far as it would go, which was about an inch. At this, the sheriff put his hand on the back of her neck and did not look from the fire. They regarded the fire in that attitude, and the puppies romped, and in the strange orange light, they all looked posed for a family portrait at a discount department store. Before going into the house, the sheriff knocked the mud off his boots, then decided that would not do, and took his boots off and left them outside the back door on the porch. Mrs. Shuping put two eggs on to boil. The sheriff, who she thought might go 300 pounds, should not eat an egg, she knew. But it was what you ate after a swamp fire. Boiled hard, halved, heavy salt and pepper, and tasting somehow of smoke. And it was all she had anyway. They peeled the eggs at the metal table and put the shells in the aluminum pot the eggs had cooked in. Mrs. Shuping peeled hers neatly, no more than 4 pieces of shell. But the sheriff rolled his on the table under his palm until it was a fine mosaic. He rubbed the tiny bits of shell off with his thumb. When the sheriff came out of the bathroom and stood by the bed, Mrs. Shuping became frightened beyond the normal, understandable apprehensions a woman can have before going to bed with a new man, especially the largest one it is conceivable to go to bed with. She also had a concern for the bed itself. And even for the structural capacity of the house. But that was hysterical. The sheriff was safely upstairs, and no matter what he did, he would not get any heavier. Something else frightened her. It was as if a third party were in the room, a kind of silent presence. And then she realized what it was. The sheriff, naked, without his creaking leather, was quiet for the first time, a soundless man. It gave her goosebumps.
Get in.
Mrs. Shuping decided it was best to trust a man this large in the execution of his own desire and let him near smother her. He made a way for air for her over one of his shoulders and began what he was about, which seemed to be an altogether private program at first. But then got better until she could tell that the sheriff was not simply a locomotive on his own track. And things got evenly communal. Traces of smoky fire in the room, but enough air. Mrs. Shuping thought of winnowing and sailing records, and her mother, and of how long a gizzard has to cook to be tender. How much longer than a liver? And she lost track until she heard the sheriff breathing, about to die like a catfish on a hot sidewalk, and stop. "Miss Shoop," the sheriff said, when he could talk. "This is my philosophy of life, and it proves it. Almost everything can happen. Yin-yang." "What would be an example, Sheriff?" "Well, this," he said, his arms arcing in the space over them and re-ballasting the bed. "And did you hear about them boys kill that girl for, for sex?" The sheriff then related the details of a rape case that he had worked on. It was not the sort of talk she expected to follow a first time. But she let him go on and found that she did not mind it. The sheriff had set in motion the pattern of rude and somewhat random speech that would follow their lovemaking in the high, springy bed under the ripped ceiling. You would be allowed to say whatever was on your mind without regard to etiquette or setting. Once, it embarrassed her to recall, she declaimed, apropos of nothing, while they were still breathless, "Listen, I have a father and a mother. I'm a real person." To this, the sheriff firmly rejoined, "I think the whole god country has lost its mind. I don't doubt it, Miss Shupin said. They could talk like this for hours. Their meanings rarely intersecting. The last thing the sheriff said before leaving that first night was, 50 pounds in the morning. They'll be all right under the porch. Mrs. Shuping slept well, wondering what 50 pounds of what under the house before she drifted off. The sheriff had initiated a pattern with this remark, too, but she did not know it. She would find that the sheriff was given to talking about things that he did not bother to preface or explain, and that she preferred not asking what the hell he was talking about. Whatever the hell he was talking about would become apparent. And so far, the sheriff had delivered no unwanted surprises. She saw just about what she was getting. In the river of her winnowing life, the sheriff represented a big boulder in the bed of the dwindling stream. It eventually would be eroded from underneath and would settle and maybe sink altogether. Mrs. Shuping, therefore, did not find the facts of her aggressively winnowing life and the solid, vigorous mass of her new man to be in conflict at all. She had never known a man so naturally unrefined. Despite his bulk, the sheriff gave her a good feeling. That was as specific as she could be about it. He gives me a good feeling, she thought, marveling at the suspicious simplicity of the sentiment. She had a dream of going into the swamp and finding her opera records unharmed and retrieving them and playing them for the sheriff, who, as his appreciation of them increased, began to dance with her in a ballroom that somehow appeared in her house, the operas having become waltzes, and began to lose weight, becoming as slender as a bullfighter. Then, in the swamp again, she found the records hung in the trees and melted into long, twisted shapes that suggested, of all things, the severely herniated intestines of a chimpanzee she'd once seen in a cheap roadside wild animal attraction. She woke up glad to wake up. She would look for no records and wish no diet upon the sheriff. Have my head examined, she muttered, getting out of bed. In a very vague way, Mrs. Shuping had decided before the decisions and lack of decisions that set her life on its course of winnowing that having her head examined was going to be the certain price if she did not begin to clear a few or many things out of it. She saw at the end of theories of consciousness and lay physics and broad familiarity with things topical and popular, a wreck of the mind, her mind, on the rocks of pointless business and information. None of that knowledge, good or bad, simple or sophisticated, was ever going to allow her to do anything except more of it. Drive another 80 miles to another touring concert or exhibition. Read another article on the mating dynamics of the American anole. She decided that a green lizard doing push-ups with his little red centerboard coming out of his throat was one thing. But if she read about it anymore, saw any more stylized drawings of distensible throat flaps on vectors heading for each other like units in a war game, she was going to be in trouble. This was a petty, flighty kind of fed-upness to reach, and not carefully thought out, she knew, but she did not care. If you looked carefully at B number W128, who was vibrating at such and such a frequency, wagging his butt at 42 degrees on the compass, my God. Of all her pre-winnowing interests, this arcane science was her favorite. Yet, oddly enough, it was the first to go. It had looked insupportable in a way that, say, time had not. Yet over the years, she had decided, once time, etc., had also been abandoned, that the lizards and bees and flow mechanics were supportable in the extreme by comparison, as were the weirdly eclectic opera records, more justified than the morning classical music shows on public radio. But once she had opted for winnowing, there was no pulling back. "I'm going beyond Walden," she told herself. And soon thereafter began eyeing the cluttered swamp, which was not simple enough. So she winnowed to prevent having her head examined. If it were to be, she wanted them to find nothing in it. She knew enough about the process. Her mother had had her head examined many times. Mrs. Shuping did not like her mother, so that was all she needed to know about having your head examined. Not for her. She looked out the window that morning and saw a man with a white stripe down each pant leg walk away from the house and get in a yellow truck, which then drove off. When she investigated, she found a 50-pound sack of dog food on the porch and the two puppies scratching at it very fast as if they would dig in spoonfuls to China. After their first night together, the sheriff arrived without Mrs. Shuping's having to set the swamp on fire. The sheriff had established the two things he would do for or to Mrs. Shuping. One was talk trash in bed, and the other was supply her with goods and services that came through his connections as sheriff. After the dog food, which had belonged to the county police dogs until her puppies got it, a crew of prisoners showed up one morning and painted the entire porch, which surrounded her house, with yellow road paint, giving the house the look of a cornball flying saucer about to take off. The sheriff appeared that night, the fluorescent paint more than ever inspectable then, beaming with pride. He did not remark upon it directly or ask Mrs. Shuping how she liked it, but from his face, which in its pride nearly partook of the same yellow glow, it was obvious that he was sure she liked her hideous new paint job. She could not deny it. She had watched the crew from a lawn chair, drinking coffee while they changed her haunted-looking, unpainted, unannounced house into something like ballpark mustard with mica in it. Never asked them what they thought they were doing. Nor had she asked the man with the shotgun what he was doing. And now it did not seem proper to ask the sheriff. The dog food was done. The porch under which the puppies were to live was done. And something else would be done. And it was in the spirit of winnowing to let it be done. But in bed that night, before they got to the sheriff's spontaneous trash-talking, she did let out one question. "Listen," she said, "isn't this... prisoners and..." She made a kind of scalloping motion with a hand in the air where he could see it. "I appreciate it, but isn't it graft or something?" The sheriff took a deep breath as if impatient, but she already knew he would not, if he were impatient, show it. He was a man who could talk about rape in bed, but in other important ways, he was a gentleman. He was breathing to compose. "If you see something I have," he said, "there is something behind it I have given." He breathed for a while. "Law is a series of deals," he said next. "And so is law enforcement." More breathing. "Nobody in law enforcement, unlike law, makes money near what the time goes into it." They looked at the ceiling. "If you don't do Wall Street, this is how you do it." A deep sigh. "That dogfighter I got your puppies from made $15,000 the next week in 1 hour. And I let him do it. And I did not take a dime. You have two good dogs. He would have knocked in the head." Mrs. Shuping was sorry that she'd asked and never did again. But if she saw the sheriff studying something about the place, she might attempt to steer him off. He seemed to look askance at her mixed and beat-up pots and pans one night, and fearful that he would strip the country prison kitchen of its commercial cookware, perhaps inspired by the odd presence of her commercial toaster, and stuff it all into hers, she informed him casually that broken-in pots were a joy to handle. She missed his sighting for the deck and the boardwalk into the swamp, however. The one clue mumbled in his sleep, ground womanized. That'll be hard. She did not know how to interpret until the ground contact-rated pressure-treated posts were being put in the yard behind her house and on back into the swamp by the blackfellows with the post-hole diggers. And the largest, shiniest, knottiest, most gruesome and handsome arms she had ever seen. She watched them as she'd watched the house painters, this time putting brandy in her coffee. Something she had tried once before and not liked the taste of. Sitting there drinking spiked coffee, she felt herself becoming a character in the gravitational pull of the sheriff, despite, she realized, efforts nearly all her life not to become a character, except for calling herself Mrs. Shooping. The boardwalk through the thin swamp looked miraculous, as if the burning had been a plan of architectural landscaping. The handsome, lean swamp, the walk suggesting a miniature railroad trestle going out into it, resembled a park. If you winnowed and got down pretty clean and were normal, she thought, and something happened, like a big Bubba sheriff and thousands of dollars of windfall contracting, and a completely different kind of life than you had had, and you started becoming a character, and you paid nothing for it and did not scheme for it, and it reversed your winnowing, and you liked brandy suddenly, at least in coffee, while watching men who put classical sculpture to shame. Was it your fault?
James Norton read us Paget Powell's The Winnowing of Mrs. Shooping. Readings by the versatile Jim Norton can be found on the CDs Are We There Yet? And Timeless Classics. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.